and some music. Welcome, everyone. This is Bruce Baer. I'm a physician's assistant, and I'm your host of Ask an Expert Anything. And this is a weekly call that is live, or you may be listening to it in the replay. And this week, it's Ask a Podiatrist Anything. Our expert is none other than Dr. Bruce Fawcett. He is a podiatrist with 25-plus years' experience in podiatry, which, as you probably know, is care of the feet, ankles, and lower legs. He is involved in the medical care and the surgical care of that part of the body, and he's on the line with us now. Welcome, Dr. Fawcett.
Oh, thanks a lot, Mr. Baer. It's a pleasure to be here. I look forward to helping answer any questions anybody might have about their foot and lower leg problems.
Well, that's great. Let me get you to just tell us once again I've got people here who asked questions who I know weren't on our call the last time. So why don't you tell them about your experience, your educational background, and you know, the thing that attracted you to into podiatry, and you know, just a little background on you and a background on how a podiatrist is trained.
All right, I'll be glad to do that, Bruce. Give you a little thumbnail sketch about my little part of the world and where I come from and my education. I'm married. I have three kids. I live in Raleigh. I work in Raleigh and Chapel Hill, North Carolina. And I went to podiatry school in Cleveland, Ohio, undergraduate school in Pennsylvania. The podiatry education is a postgraduate education, and it's a four-year program. And then after that, you serve a residency of 1, 2, or 3 years. During that time, you learn your surgical skills and clinical skills. You hone them in a little better. We serve a whole host of different types of population out there, from the very young to the very old. Some of the work we do is a treatment of overuse problems, sports injuries, or people that have just hurt themselves through work, or as we get a little bigger and gain a little weight. Some of our work has to do with skin, dermatology, nail problems, warts, common calluses and corns, and some of our problems involve helping people with deformities such as bunions and hammer toes, bumps and lumps, surgical problems usually when bad enough. And a whole host of our work involves helping the diabetic with their foot problems, because being diabetic, well, they have a whole peculiar group of symptoms and signs that can make them more prone to foot problems. But the podiatrist has full legal prescribing privileges and surgical privileges. We're licensed in all 50 states. Our degree after our name is a DPM, a Doctor of Podiatric Medicine. We're trained in the traditional allopathic, it would be the terminology. In other words, cause and effect, scientific study for the basis of the study of a disease and cure. So that tells you a little bit about me and where I come from. I'm board certified by the American Board of Podiatric Surgery, something that a third of the podiatrists have, and have privileges at area hospitals and at a surgical center. And much of my day is involved treating the kind of patients I just described. And then maybe half a day a week I work, or a whole day sometimes, at the surgical center or hospitals. The most serious things we deal with are the limb-threatening issues that affect diabetics. And we're pretty instrumental in helping save limbs, along with all the whole host of other doctors and nurses who do that. And that's important, because about 80,000 diabetics a year succumb to some sort of amputation of their toe, foot, or lower leg. And that's a kind of a terrible statistic. I don't want to talk too much about all of that, but I'd be glad to answer any questions, and I hope that gives a general background on what I do for a living and where I come from.
Well, I think that's great. Yeah, I think that was very helpful, and it allows anyone listening now and anyone listening in the future to have a better understanding of what a podiatrist is and what you'd be able to do for them if they decided to go to a podiatrist for their foot, ankle, or lower leg problems. Yes. All right, well, maybe we can get into asking some questions or answering some questions that have been asked by people. Since you can't see my screen, most of these people are listening on their computers. I guess it's probably a little easier for them. They can do something else while they listen, so it's kind of like listening to the radio for them. But they have a little box on their computer, and they can type questions into me.
Right.
And some of these have been typed in tonight and some in over the last couple of days as I've advertised this to the people who are aware that I do this. So the first person is a lady by the name of Catherine, and she says, how do you know exactly if an arch support or orthotic fits properly? And then she has a couple other follow-up questions. Is there more than one arch and foot that needs to be considered? Why do some people have so much trouble getting used to an arch support, and is it possible to have too high of an arch, and what problems does that cause? So I guess she wants to know about arch supports, arches in general, whether they're, you have more than one, whether they're too high, and why, if you put an arch support in, it might be difficult to get used to wearing it.
It's a great first question. Most people, like a lot of things in medicine, there's a first and a second, a third degree burn, a first and a second and a third degree sprain. And you might think about arches in a similar fashion. You can have flat feet or more or less a medium arch or a very high arched foot. For a whole host of people, we're in the middle. Most of us probably have a little bit of an arch. Now, when you're off weight bearing and you look at your foot, well, almost everybody has some sort of arch off weight bearing. The proper way to sort of determine if you're having what kind of foot structure you have is just to be standing in a normal stance, not necessarily with your feet, your ankles together, but just a normal stance as you would be, say, standing in a line, and look down and see if you have an arch, or see if your muscles and tendons on the inside of your foot and leg are working real hard to maintain that arch. So most people, if they have a medium arch and they have average work expectancies and standing and walking, don't have a lot of foot pain. But some with a very flat foot in particular, their feet get very achy and tired. This can even be seen in children where they'll complain that they don't want to stand, they don't want to walk. They generally don't have what you might call as much pain as they would fatigue. In older individuals, if they have a standing job, especially one that just stands in one place, well, they'll start getting pain in their arches and through the lower leg and the front of the tibia, and just keeps kind of, in many instances, going up. For many people, a good shoe is adequate. Not everybody by any means needs an arch support. But if your foot fatigue easily and your legs and your knees fatigue easily, or you're getting kind of just your foot tired by the end of the day, let's say you work in retail and you stand in one place 8 or 10 hours, you just can't wait to get home and get off your feet. Well, then yes, some sort of arch support would be good. Now, the terminology that's thrown around can be a little confusing to people. Arch support, of course, is any kind of intersole that you wear in your shoe. Many arch supports that you would buy or see at a drugstore just don't have enough oomph, don't have enough force to them, aren't high enough, bottom out right away. You can't expect a person who weighs 150 to 300 pounds to stand on something like that and get any real good help from it for any length of time. Might help, might feel good right away, but after a while it's going to bottom out. Better arch supports are more rigid, and most people can almost always tolerate an arch support that is fairly have some rigidity to it. You don't want to have something that just folds in half. I'm trying to avoid brand names here because just like cars. There's cheap cars and expensive cars, all made by the same company. You could probably say the same as some arch supports. But a good arch support, it should have some rigidity to it in the middle of it. Now, in many instances, some shoe stores and companies have made their names on promoting something more than just an arch support. They tell you that they'll take care of all your back pains and all the fatigue and everything if you just go into their store, buy their shoes, and buy their InnerSole. And they'll call that InnerSole an orthotic. But if you would talk to a podiatrist, an orthopedist, a physical therapist, a physician, most of us would prefer to use the term orthotic for a device that's custom-made to the foot, made from an actual cast of the foot. And these devices then can definitely take into account whether you have a very flat foot, a very medium arch foot, or a very high arch foot. The high arch foot can tolerate very little in the way of support. The arch is already there in a high arch person, so they don't need a whole lot underneath their arch. Many times a high arch person needs a device that pads the heel and the forefoot, because that's where they get all of their pressure. So when looking and shopping and considering these things, I would advise a person to, yes, you want to be able to make sure that it feels good. Most of the time, an arch supported as medium strength or medium firmness, you know, that'll be the best. The inner soles that are sold in a running shoe store will probably be, generally speaking, have a little bit more integrity and firmness to them than the ones just sold in the drugstore that are more on the more like inner soles rather than true arch support. And then custom-made orthotics made from an actual three-dimensional cast, or in some instances a computer-generated cast or a computer-generated image, those are going to be generally far superior. There's a little bit of hocus-pocus in the shoe stores, and stand on this, and this image will tell you exactly what you need. I would counsel patients to be wary of that to at least a certain extent. If a person cannot tolerate an over-the-counter support, as our Catherine here has questioned, then they might do better with a custom-made device. That's where a podiatrist or an orthotist or a prosthetist would come in handy. Those would be the three main professions who would be best suited to making a custom-made device to a mold of a foot rather than a shoe store. Now, many shoe stores are doing good work, so I got to be careful, and I don't want to be, as it were, tooting our own horn too much as podiatrists. But when if it gets into something more than just an over-the-counter, off-the-shelf device, and you're still not doing good with that kind of a device, well, that's when you probably need a custom-made orthotic. The people that I find need custom-made orthotics are, for instance, a pharmacist. He walks very little, stands in about an 8-foot place, walks back and forth. Those people who stand at a machine all day, say, sorting mail, post office workers. Teachers often need an orthotic. Runners, people who run over 20 miles a week and start to develop symptoms as they age, they do good with orthotics. People with heel pain often do very good with orthotics. There's nothing wrong with trying an over-the-counter InnerSole sometimes first. If it helps a little, an orthotic might help a lot. Many people just with an over-the-counter InnerSole in some instances will do good enough. It's not a panacea. That is to say, it doesn't cure every foot illness. But when it's necessary, a good custom-made orthotic or a well-made firm arch support is generally very good for overuse problems, shin splints, metatarsalgia, heel pain, arch pain, and in some instances, low back pain. That's what I would say about arch supports and orthotics.
All right. Well, let me ask you a follow-up question that's kind of the opposite of that. There is a kind of a, I don't know, kind of a cult on the web, if you will, mm-hmm. of people who think that you should work out, even lifting heavy weights, and not wear shoes. Mm-hmm. And I've seen them promote, it looks like a sock. You put it on, but it has like little spaces that all your toes would go into, so it almost looks like you're barefoot, except it's covered by this stuff that has a little bit of sponginess to it, and it has a rough sole so that you don't slip. And they promote those, and I've read several articles of people saying how good their feet felt, and these little socky things cost about $45.
Wow.
An inexpensive pair of running shoes could buy that for that price. But mm-hmm. I wondered if you knew anything about that particular device that they're promoting, or what your thoughts were about doing athletic activity, whether it be standing still, lifting weights, or jumping activities, things like that, and without any support at all, essentially barefooted or with minimal coverage of the foot so as to avoid injury just to the skin.
I see. I understand the question, and I believe that by and large you should have a shoe on that absorbs weight and dissipates energies for most weight-bearing exercises, if not all. I know something such as yoga, of course, and some martial arts are done barefoot. I'm very careful with what I tell people about these kind of exercises. And if you can do some of that, if you're lightweight or you're petite or small enough, it's just like physics. If your mass is small enough, you can probably get away with some of that. But as you get any kind of actual weight or mass on you, it's better to have a shoe on for almost all exercises. Yoga is fine in some instances, but I've seen people in some of those poses where they're overextending or overflexing their feet, they could do some damage. Many people are helped by exercise. Exercise is a good thing. The feet were basically made for walking or running, and other exercises that we do with our feet, you probably should have shoes on almost always, with very few exceptions. It's amazing how many times I've seen people, and there's certain cultures where shoes are worn less. In the summer, when women and men both wear flip-flops and sandals a lot more, I see a lot more injuries, overuse problems, because a flip-flop or a sandal or a slipper is no substitute for a shoe. And of course, being barefoot just takes that a step further. I think you should minimize the time you're barefoot, and it'd be very rare that being barefoot would be considered a good exercise practice. Hey, when I go to the beach, I'm barefoot, Bruce. Don't get me wrong. But if I'm standing on the beach and I look down and I see the pier a mile away, I got to put shoes on to walk that distance. So shoes are good.
All right. The next question from Robbie kind of dovetails right in what you've been talking about, and he's wanting to know the difference between fallen arches and flat feet. It sounds like you might have explained that, but maybe you could talk on that just for a second.
Yeah, let me elaborate a little bit. Flat feet, well, our body goes through a progression of when we're born. When we're born between the ages of 0 and 2 years of age, and you're developing the skills necessary for standing and walking, every child has what's called a real wide basic gait. Their hips are externally rotated a whole lot, because they're clumsy, and they're just getting the feel of those muscles and bones. And so they have to have real externally rotated lower legs and feet. And that in itself looks very flat-footed. We don't need to worry too much about that for most individuals. But it's worth mentioning that when a person's flat-footed, either as a baby or as an adult, they often have their feet very much externally rotated. Now, it's very rare, but in some instances, there's a tendon called the posterior tibial tendon, and it can malfunction, and it's graded on 3 levels, just like other things medically, mild, moderate, or severe. A posterior tibial tendon can spontaneously rupture. Generally, it's an older-aged individual where this will happen. Sometimes it happens in younger people with sports injuries, but mostly it's an older age person thing. And now that we have MRIs in the last 2-3 decades, you can actually see that. Whereas before, it was suspected, but hard to confirm. So MRIs are real good at determining if the posterior tibial tendon, the major tendon that helps hold up the arch, is ruptured. Most of the time, it can be diagnosed by a clinical exam. A person who has a ruptured posterior tibial tendon, they cannot stand on one foot and come up on the tiptoes on that symptomatic foot. That would then, that lends some credibility to the term fallen arch. You had an arch, your posterior tibial tendon ruptured, now you have a fallen arch. Other people are born or have a tendency towards flat-footedness, and this is caused by ligamentous laxity. Just to review a little bit, if you remember, our bones are held together by ligaments, and then above the ligaments are the muscles and tendons that allow for motion and movement. Well, they help, the muscles and tendons help hold up the foot, as we just talked about with the posterior tibial tendon. But some people, their ligaments are really loosey-goosey, and they just aren't tight enough. And that person, when they stand, will have a flat foot from early on, from like high school, junior high ages. And so that's not, in a sense, a fall. That's not a fallen arch. That's someone who was just born, quote-unquote, flat-footed. You know, in the most extreme cases, military won't take you with flat-footed conditions. I think the military is probably happy to get anybody now of right age and weight. And I think you'd have to have mighty, mighty bad flat feet for the military not to take you. So there's probably that difference. That ligamentous laxity, hypermobile, pronation is another word you'll see written a lot in running magazines and in describing a foot that's flattened out. Pronation is simply nothing more than a description of a body plane range of motion in the back of the foot. There's different terms we use to describe motion, as you well know, Bruce. Dorsiflexion, plantar flexion. All these terms describe where you're putting a body part through space. Pronation is, if you can imagine, a flattening of the back of the foot. So I think that's the best I can describe. Most people who aren't in the business, who are just, you know, would probably use the terms fallen arches or flat feet interchangeably, by and large.
All right. That's great.
All right.
We're going to go on to toenails now. Bruno from New Jersey wants to know, what's the best way to trim toenails? He wants to know, is it better to file or clip them, and is it better to soak them, or does it matter? And he says, what about those sharp little pieces of nail that grow into the skin? What's the best way to remove them? Thank you very much.
That's a great question, Bruno. And for many people, the best answer is to cut your nails straight across, not to gouge a lot into the corner, and not to leave a sharp spicule or corner in the edge of the nail. Now, granted, sometimes it's hard to trim your own toenail. It could be because the way the nail grows. Some people's nails grow curved in a lot, and they have a tendency then to want to get a little of that border out on each side because it's tender if they don't. But you want to be careful, and you don't want to go too deep, or you'll irritate the skin and set up a process by which you can get an infection, an ingrown infected toenail. And that's pretty nasty. And everybody's probably had a little bit of that. But when it's bad enough or gets inflamed enough and infected enough, then you're going to have to see someone like Bruce Baer, PAC, or Bruce Foster, podiatrist, or your general practitioner. A lot of times, that's something that has to be cut out, and that requires a little anesthesia. Now, to avoid that, Bruno's wanting to know what we can do to avoid that. So try and cut your nails straight across. You can foul them a little with the emery board. If you're prone to having an ingrown toenail, which a lot of people are of their first toenail borders in particular, then put a little Neosporin on there after you clip them. maybe a Band-Aid to drive the Neosporin in, cut down on the bacteria down in there. Some people have a fungus nail. A normal nail, if you look at your fingernails, probably are pretty normal. They have a luster. That's the description of a little bit of a shine to them. They have a thinness or an appropriate, let's say they're thin enough and not too thick. They have a normal luster and appearance. Many people over the years will get a fungus toenail, or they'll get a nail that's been damaged due to trauma of sports or wearing steel-toed shoes or just everyday living that we all go through. When you were a kid, you banged your nail on a bicycle, playing soccer. There's a million ways you bang up your feet. You know, you get up in the middle of the night to go to the bathroom and you smack your foot into a counter. I think everybody's done it, into a dresser. Everybody's done that sooner or later, or into a chair. Well, if you damage your nail bad enough in that fashion, it can grow in a peculiar fashion, a thickened fashion, or it can get a fungus to it. A nail that I'm describing now would not have a normal luster or shine to it. It wouldn't have a normal thinness, if you will. It would become thick, funny, looking, crumbly, and lose that normal color. In some instances, it would take an odor if it's a bad enough fungus infection. Well, now you got a lot more fuss and hassle to trimming your nails, and you probably need a pretty decent nail clipper that you would buy at a drugstore, the handheld kind, for such a fungus nail or a dystrophic nail. Dystrophic meaning growing in a funny fashion. So that's a much harder thing to deal with, and people sometimes have trouble finding the right nail clipper. But if you go to a drugstore and buy a good Revlon product, so that would probably be sufficient. Sometimes they have two or three joints in them. That makes them a little stronger and a little easier to use if you find it that it's hard to use a normal clipper. A lot of the little nail scissors that you see in cosmetic packs, why, they don't, you know, they just don't have enough strength to them by the time you reach down there and try and trim your nail. There's a whole host of products for fungus nails. That's always a question. I bet that's somewhere on your list there, isn't it, Bruce?
Yes.
Well, I can talk a little bit about that now, or I can let that go. But
fungus, no, go ahead. No.
Well, all right. Let's talk a little bit about the funny-looking, thick nail. And it's weird how much this can bother people. And it's also well known to me now after 25 years of practice how much it bothers some people's significant other or spouse. Some people get a little grossed out by that, but they shouldn't be, because many times you find that it's just a function of age. It has no real reflection on a person's hygiene, but they can get a fungus infection in the nail. We just see it statistically each decade in life, more and more people get them. The treatment for a fungus nail, probably the best treatment is a pill called Lamisil. Lamisil is a fairly safe drug. You got to take it one a day for 3 months for a toenail infection, and one every day for 6 weeks for a fingernail infection. Most of the time, most people can take this. Those who should never take it are those who have had significant liver disease, hepatitis, or have high liver enzymes, because the medicine will work your liver a little bit. We counsel people, for instance, who are taking Lamisil for 3 months. They should probably modify some of their alcohol intake, too, if it's more than just a glass of wine or a beer a night. Then they should probably watch that. We always measure someone's liver enzymes before we put them on Lamisil. And most everybody would also take a fungus nail culture before putting you on Lamisil. Lamisil is the trade name, and I should be careful what I'm saying. The generic is terbinafine. Lamisil used to be advertised on TV a lot, and they lost their patent, that company. They had the Digger, the Dermatophyte on TV about the time Jeopardy was on, you know, showing everybody how gross their nails were with fungus. Well, so So Madison Avenue drives a lot of things, and I some of it's good and some of it's bad, if you know what I mean. But I've had a lot of people do very good with this terbinafine medicine, and it's a one a day for 3 months. And the cure rate's about 79%, 80% plus. Now, dermatophytes are the terms we use to describe any fungus or yeast infection that gets on your skin, hair, nail. And doggone, dermatophytes can be very recurrent, very tough to treat. And there are some people who are very prone to them. People who perspire a lot, well, their skin and nail make perfect environments for the growth of fungi and yeast, and it's much harder to cure them. But you can always at least treat these things. Anybody that we've put on terbinafine, the oral pill for fungus, almost always, sooner or later, we have them using a topical fungus medicine too. Topical meaning, you know, something you put on top of your skin or nail, because we want to cut down on the colonies of the fungus that are growing on the skin and nail. Colonies, we all have on our skin or hair or nail at any given time. Well, as you know, we have some bacteria, some fungus, some virus. They don't cause a disease in the vast majority of us. But given the opportunistic, perfect environment, they can cause these diseases. Well, it's been we know that the fungus of toenail infections and skin like a cool, dark, moist environment. And this is exactly what we have in our feet inside of socks and shoes. Furthermore, very often our shoes can sort of harbor that fungus. It's hard to get a shoe completely free of that kind of fungus. So what starts out as being wouldn't it be nice if all you had to do was take a pill or rub a little cream on your foot? Well, yeah, that would be nice, but to really bring it on home and to try and prevent reoccurrences, well, then you need to do such things as air out your shoes, change your shoes, take your inner soles out, let the sun hit on them, spray them out with Lysol or appropriate any type of cleaner, powder your socks and shoes, use flip-flops in the locker room. Some people even have to use flip-flops in their own bathroom. Those people who travel a lot should probably, in motels, etc., you know, wear flip-flops around in that situation. So it's a real common condition. People that have been in the military or who share a lot of living space, college, etc., well, you're going to be a little more prone to picking up this kind of fungus. Those that, when Vietnam was over and the soldiers came back from those wet, swampy environments, an awful lot of them had athlete's foot and things like that. So that's the topical medicines, the creams and gels and ointments and lacquers, tea tree oil and all these over-the-counter and home remedies. Well, they're just not as good as that pill, terbinafine. They're probably adequate for some people. If you only have one nail that's a little bit bothersome, by all means, I don't think you need to take a three-month course of an oral antifungal. If you have 10 nails that are making you unhappy every time you look at them and your spouse the same way, and grossing you out and you don't want to go to the beach or that kind of thing, well, then terbinafine is a pretty good drug. Surgery has very little place in the role of fungus nail disease unless it's hurting real bad, and then a nail removal can be sometimes effective. That's what I should probably tell the public about nails, both the problem of incurvated, ingrown, infected toenails and fungal nails. Now, one more thing. If a person has a recurrent, chronic, incurved, infected toenail that gets pus and blood and hurts, and every time they trim it or bump it, it's an agony, Well, there's a very good surgical procedure whereby we can almost always assure success. And I'm careful with my words there. But 99 out of 100 times, we can take a nail border out and put some medicine on there, and then that nail border will not come back. Or in some instances, take a nail border and the root out, and rarely suture it up. And those kind of procedures, they're wonderful. Many people are really glad to have such a procedure done if they've been suffering with a recurrent, ingrown, incurved, infected toenail border. And again, to stress that, we're just taking the border out. We're not taking the whole nail out in those kinds of
cases. Just making the nail narrower.
That's it. That's an awful lot of talk about nails, but it certainly is something we deal with a lot. And I think those recommendations are what's appropriate.
Well, there's a fellow here, Mark, wants to know if, with regard to the fungus and that discussion, if it says some people have long toenails and some short, and does it matter for the health of the nail and feet? You know, does that? I guess he wants to know, does that predispose your nail length to one of those conditions?
Well, if your nail's too long, it'll bang into your shoes, and that can aggravate and cause. Well, for instance, runners. They're banging their nails into the end of their shoes a lot. Some people get bloody and bruised skin and nail right around there. And then, so they should probably keep their nails relatively short. Just a nail cut straight across at the very end is appropriate. It becomes harder for those who have a weight problem or the aged or the arthritic to keep their nails trimmed to just what we would consider a reasonable level. So often they can come to a podiatrist for that service alone, and that's fine. I think the answer to his question, there's no optimum length. Most people's fifth toenails are funny, small, peculiar, undergrown, if you will. I wouldn't worry about that. Just keep your nails trimmed to a reasonable level. And if you're prone to ingrown, infected nails, put Neosporin on them. I try, when people tell me that they're bothered by the appearance of the nail, women, of course, can paint their toenails. And that's generally, I don't have a problem with that. It's not a treatment that cures the fungus, but the fungus that one gets in a toenail will never, like, get into your system. It doesn't get inside of you. Unless you're immunosuppressed or very sick. So there's nothing wrong with a little bit of just disguising of the nail plate with polish. If that's the simplest answer, well, that's okay. If that makes you happy about the cosmetics of the whole thing.
Let's see, I had a question come to my mind. Oh, I know what it was. I've read and thought this might be a good time to, you know, for you to confirm or refute this report, but I've read that women go to health spas and they soak their feet in these baths and then they do pedicures and things like that, mm-hmm. and that I've read that could be a potential source for getting a nail fungus infection. I'm not putting down pedicures or anything like that, but
right.
I've been told or read that the way these basins are hygienically cleaned can make or break that process. Do you have anything to say about that? Carefully?
I think that's a good question. And every summer, throughout the year, I will see somebody who comes in and their history reveals that they believe that they went to a pedicurist who was overzealous. It isn't so much the soaking and the basins, I think, as much as it is, someone was overzealous in pushing the cuticle back, or possibly the instrument itself wasn't as clean as it could be. I've seen and read of rare exposés of someone getting Pseudomonas or a methicillin-resistant staph from the water of a spa or a jacuzzi or a pedicurist. These are pretty rare incidences. And I think, by and large, it's better than it used to be. It seems like I would see more of this in the past. I know this. We have an autoclave in my office, and I know you do too, Mr. Bear. Every instrument that touches a human being that's going to do anything to their skin or nail has been sterilized by an autoclave, a process by which it renders every bacteria, fungus, and virus known to man, it eliminates it. You know, a steam sterilizer.
And then you store it in a pack that keeps it that way.
Yeah, exactly. And anybody who's had a microbiology course knows kind of what I'm talking about. Anyway, I really don't think that there's very many or any spas that have an autoclave. I bet they can eliminate 99% of the bacteria and fungi if they have good health practices, you know, bead sterilizers, good various types of topical antiseptics. But it's true that the only way to eliminate every one of them, every bacteria and fungus virus known to man, is through an autoclave. Some patients of mine who enjoy a pedicure, manicure, they buy their own instruments and take care of themselves. And I think that's a pretty decent idea for some folks. And I would be weary of going to any pedicurist, manicurist who didn't have some sort of recommendation from a friend or a colleague or a family member, somebody who said, yeah, I've been there, and they're okay, they're clean. So, yes, I see people, and then the person doing the work themselves, if they get too overzealous with pushing cuticle and cutting nail borders and fouling and sanding things, yeah, they can in some instances get an infection going from penetration of the skin and getting bacteria punched down in there. It happens. It's fairly rare. It's probably the same with fungus. But I'll tell you this, too. For instance, I can speak from personal this from my own personal viewpoint rather than just something medically. I've been going to the local YMCA down here for 25-plus years. I don't use flip-flops. I don't use sandals. I have not gotten any type of athlete's foot infection or athlete's foot nail infection. And I think a lot of it has to do with just what you bring. That is, a genetic predisposition. Most diseases are a combination of genetics and environment. Some people are going to get athlete's foot nail and skin because their mama and their daddy and every one of their sisters and brothers have it, and they perspire a lot, and it's just the way God put them together. And other people probably never get them. And then, so sure, you can get athlete's foot, and you can get fungus and bacteria from a whole number of different sources. And in some instances, a pedicurist or a manicurist who is not clean, yeah, you could get one in that fashion. But I think it's better than it used to be. I just don't see the same kind of history from patients as I used to there.
All right. Well, that kind of puts that wives' tale to rest. Someone by the name of Susan from Worcester says, warts, do they all need to be treated, especially plantar warts? She wants to know if plantar warts will go away like some other warts will, and are there any good home remedies?
Oh, boy. I know you could talk about warts too, couldn't you, Mr. Bear?
A little bit, but I'll defer to you.
Well, I appreciate that. Anybody who treats the foot or any human being, like Mr. Bear, a physician's assistant, we see people coming in with warts. Warts are caused by a virus, the human papilloma virus. There are a mess of viruses out there, but only this human papilloma virus causes these funny little skin growths. Now, a plantar wart, by definition, is a wart that occurs in the bottom of the foot. The plantar surface of the foot is just the bottom surface of the foot. There are different descriptions for warts, plantar warts, mosaic warts. Well, that's a wart that has maybe a little satellite wart near it and a couple small dots beyond it. Mosaic, meaning sort of a pattern. So we'll see people that have one wart. Some people just have one wart. And they can vary in size from as small as a match head to, I've seen, large mosaic patterns several inches in diameter. Most warts occur in adolescents and teenagers and young adults. Once again, there are some families that seem like every person in the family gets a wart. I have a family that comes to see me in my practice, and this lady has five children, and every one of them has had a wart by the time they were 9 or 10, and she has warts as an adult. Well, this is something that this family is going to have to deal with. The best medicine in the world doesn't seem to be helping them. These warts that are caused by a virus get into the skin just deep enough to cause a thickening of several layers of the epidermis. But it seems in these people who don't get rid of them, it doesn't stimulate their own immune system, or they have an immune system deficiency that doesn't seem to slough the wart. Many people will get a wart. It'll last anywhere from 6 weeks to 6 months, and then they spontaneously resolve. Their own body somehow gets the message, and the immunity system kicks on, and it gets rid of that wart. Other people, the wart persists and can hurt if it's in a weight-bearing area. Now, the original question was, do all warts need treatment? It's a great question. If you have one small wart that doesn't hurt you, I would look at that different than someone who has 5 or 10 that hurt them. So a little bit, I think any wart is deserving of some sort of treatment. It's likely that they might spread, or get deeper, or become painful if left untreated. There are exceptions, but by and large, it's an invasion of the skin, doesn't belong there. Let's try and get rid of it. I had a patient this very day who had a very small wart right next to her fifth toenail plate, and she said it did not hurt, but she wanted to get rid of it. And once again, of all things, her significant other didn't like the wart. So you get into these kind of issues a little bit. Anyway, with her, we simply trimmed it down with a sterile blade and froze it with a liquid nitrogen. And she'll be scraping that down with a pumice stone at night or some sort of scraper and putting a mild acid on it and covering that up. And in so doing, we hope to eventually get the wart to slough all the way off. She'll probably need one or two more treatments of me trimming it and freezing it. In some instances, we'll numb the area up with a local anesthetic and circle it with a blade. That is, circumscribe it with a sterile blade and pop it out or curette it out, a curette being a small spoon-like surgical instrument, and just sort of get it out that way. That can be very effective for some people with a wart on a weight-bearing area, like right underneath the first toe, and then that hurts all the time, so we cut that one out. The truth is, even when cut out completely and exactly right and all the margins of the wart being removed, you can get a wart reoccurrence, whether we trim it and freeze it, whether we numb it up and scoop it out, whether you use laser on it, whether you freeze it, or use toxic chemicals like the acids in products like Compound W and wart removers. Warts can be very, very hard to get rid of in some individuals. So I think warts should be treated. I think you want the treatment to fit the disease. To use a cliche, punishment to fit the crime, or you don't want the cure to be worse than the disease, but you should be trying to fight that thing to get it off of there. For many people, that means numbing them up and scooping it out. For others, it means trimming it and freezing it. If there are a whole host of treatments for warts, both medical and home remedies, and quite frankly, all these other treatments, in my opinion, are there only because, doggone it, they can be very hard to get rid of. And some of the home remedies that I've seen get pretty crazy, and hard to understand. I've seen people, everything from covering them with duct tape. I think that just allows the area to become super saturated with perspiration and moisture and eventually slough off. I think using duct tape over top of acids is okay. I don't understand people who talk about using banana peels on their wart. And I've heard of that also. I've seen well-meaning published pharmacists who has a column in the paper say such things. And I don't get that. I mean, I can't see that. There are people who, in a sense, witch them off or, some of these old home remedies.
We used to have a guy who bought our warts.
Yeah, country medicine, exactly. And
yeah, he didn't buy them. We paid him to take them.
There you go.
Yeah.
So I think any of that is safe is okay. And there is some mind over matter with warts. And I think sometimes it's just coincidental. A lot of people have speculated that any of these things that are homeopathic or home remedies that seem to work on warts, well, it's just coincidental. But I believe there's a little bit of mind over matter with warts and that there is something going on there. I cannot tell you what it is. I don't ever scoff at things such as prayer or, these kind of people that can believe they have some sort of magic that'll work them off. I think that's okay. Any of that's okay as an adjunct to the science of treating it. So warts should be treated if they hurt, and they should probably be treated if they don't hurt. They are, someone with warts with a bunch of siblings around the same age, that person might want to use some. Mom or dad might want to make sure they're using flip-flops in the shower. We see more warts when people have been to the ocean, or rather to the swimming pool. I see more on the people, kids that are into gymnastics who do them barefoot. And it's just a kind of a nasty little problem, one of those growing up or adolescent problems, like wisdom teeth or a whole host of other things that you just got to go through many times.
Well, it sounds like it might have something a little bit to do with an immature immune system and then exposure, and maybe even some hygiene, possibly, since it's more in younger people, and it might be okay to treat them with over-the-counter stuff at home, like Compound W and a pumice stone. If that's not working, then they need to see somebody like you.
That's well put, Bruce, and I'm glad you brought up that concept of, once you're exposed to warts, many people never get them again because they probably have the immunity woken up within them. Yeah, that's good advice. We don't want the cure worsen disease, so self-treatment on some of these things is okay for a while, and if it keeps it under control, I completely agree with that.
All right. We have one more question that I think we have time for. Donna says that her toes next to her baby toe, so I guess that would be the fourth toe, counting the big toe as number one.
Right.
So her fourth toes, she describes them as sideways, so I'm assuming that they bend in underneath another toe. And she says they get blisters, and she wants to know what she can do. Is there a sock she can get or something she can do to prevent herself from getting these blisters?
I think she's done a good job of describing something I see pretty commonly. Sometimes the actual little bit of fat pad on the end of your toe can, like, if you will, get squished underneath the adjacent, say, third toe. Most of the time, she would be describing what I see as a fourth toe that curves inwards towards the midline of the body, and then she would get a little bit of a blister. Well, some people get corns or blisters on bent toes. Description sounds like what we would call a hammer toe. Kind of funny little names of problems in the front of the foot, hammer toes, and bunions, a large toe joint that's arthritic. But a hammer toe is toes 2 through 5, 2, 3, 4, or 5, that's bent, turned in. The conservative treatment for such things would be toe separators. They have foam toe separators. There's various things like that that Dr. Scholes sells in the pharmacy, or your podiatrist could get you pieces of tube. One thing is called tube foam. It's like foam rubber that you put over the toe. Some products now have silicone in the little sleeve that you put over the toe. And that has a pretty nice effect at reducing blistering and corns. And in some instances, shoes, of course, have a lot to do with how much a toe is getting squeezed or bent or shoved around. You can't talk to a podiatrist for an hour without hearing something about shoes. So the shoe toe box should be wide enough and deep enough. And for those times when a lady has to feel like she needs to dress up, the higher the heel and the tighter the toes, the more you're going to be prone to those kind of problems. So if you have hammer toes or bent digits, pad them off, toe separators, tube foam. Yes, in some instances, we have to do surgery to derotate a toe, to straighten it out. Reduction of blisters through powders, foot powders and creams, emollients, that would be appropriate too. In the summertime, when you can wear open-toed shoes, that would probably be helpful. That's about hammer toes, Bruce.
All right. Well, I think we've just about come to the end of another hour. I really appreciate the fact that you've been so thorough and so free with your time.
Well, I appreciate the invitation. Anything I can do? The American Podiatric Medical Association has plenty of free advice about foot problems from a podiatry standpoint. And I'm just glad to be able to talk with you tonight, Bruce. I appreciate the invite.
Now, we've got a couple other questions. I forgot to refresh this thing, but we talked about walking today, and we never did get around to that subject when we were at work today, but Dr. Foss and I work one day a week together in the same office. Ty wants to know, this is Mark. He wants to know, what are the best socks to use for walking? Are the high-tech ones any better than cotton or wool?
It's a great question again. Running shoe store people are knowledgeable. I'd go to the one who looks like he owns a store rather than the young person who's working there part-time, if you know what I'm saying. But running shoe store people are good on information, and I think there is something to be said for the new high-tech socks that have built right into them some space-age things that are wick moisture away from the skin, have antibacterial and antifungal properties through silver and other types of ions and things that are built into the sock. And whereas at one point, I would have said, oh, yeah, cotton polyester or cotton polyester wool is what you need for athletic socks and walking socks. Now it's probably true that some of these socks, and of course they can get quite expensive, are maybe a little better if you're going to be really putting down the miles, or if you're prone to fungal, bacterial, and blisters type problems. Walking is such a good exercise. You don't need any special equipment except good socks and good shoes. It's virtually part of every heart rehab program in the world, I would think. And, it's just something that's it's found to reduce people's depression. It's almost always prescribed for that. It's good for your heart. It's good for your head. You don't have to spend $1,000 to join a club. And you see all people of all ages doing it. You see them doing it in the mall. You see them do it outside. And you see them do it with their dogs. And, I can't hardly say enough good things about walking. And it's, that's what our feet were made for. To be blunt, our feet were made for walking rather than martial arts or kickboxing or yoga. And all those things are good in their own way and their own right. But they're harder on your feet than walking is. And the muscles and bones and tendons, ligaments inside the foot and those that originate outside the foot that insert on the foot, they all work better if you walk. And your circulation to your extremities will stay better if you walk. So walking's a good thing. I'm a believer in it, and I certainly walk some every week. I mix it up with other exercises. I guess that's probably a true statement, too. do a lot of different exercises, but walking should be part of it, or running if you're healthy enough.
Well, I think that's true. One of the things about the high-tech socks, from my point of view, is I love to go to cities that are noted for walking and take walking tours. And you know, I'll go and spend 4 or 5 days in a city and take 3 or 4 walking tours of maybe architecture and vegetation and whatever.
Yeah.
And I like to travel really, really light. And what I found about these high-tech socks is that I only need 2 pair.
About.
You know, the pair I got on and the pair I washed out in the sink and hung up on a chair, you know, and they dry out in a few minutes, and I have a clean pair for the next day. So,
right.
So it allows me to travel really light. I can travel 1 small suitcase and take it right on the plane with me. So that's one advantage of the high-tech socks.
Sure.
I found the price to be worth it because it saves me a lot of time and the amount of stuff I have to carry with me.
Surely. I understand that. And I know from when I've done backpacking that under socks that wick moisture away from your skin towards the more thicker wool or cotton socks are good too. So yeah, socks are important, and of course good shoes are important. Replacing your shoes every 6 months or so if you're a walker or a runner would be ideal. I'm not going to sit here and tell you I replace every pair of my shoes at 6 months, but I'm pretty good about making sure they're gone within a year. And take a look at them. Well, if you hold your shoe up and you push the front of your shoe up and it looks like a leprechaun shoe, well, it's time to get rid of that shoe. It should have rigidity and firmness to it. I hope I've been able to paint a little bit of a picture there. But, you need to replace your shoes frequently, especially if you're prone to foot problems.
I've given your advice from your last, from the last time I interviewed you about the stiff last, good heel counter, box toe to a zillion patients.
great, Bruce. I appreciate that. I'm glad to be your friend. I've gotten as much information from you as you've gotten from me, and I appreciate the opportunity to share some of this stuff.
Well, one last question, then we're gonna call tonight. What is the best thing to do for tired feet? That's a broad question.
I hope I won't insult the questioner by saying, of course, rest them. Some people really enjoy a good foot massage. I'm somebody that doesn't enjoy a good foot massage. But just the normal things that you would do to rejuvenate a foot could be a lukewarm salt water soak if you have good circulation, or a soapy water soak. And it might sound contrary to that or ironic, but if your feet, you could, in some instances, roll them on, say, a frozen soda bottle. If your arches are tired, that would be good for your arches, which are often the same thing as tired feet. But just good hygiene, maybe a little soak, good emollient or cream. But don't put that between the toes. But a good emollient or cream, good hygiene, good soaks. In some instances, ice or a cold therapy for the bottom of the arches if they're sore and tired. And avoid going barefoot. A lot of people, if they've been on their feet all day in a certain shoe, they come home, kick that shoe off. That's good to let it get air and everything. But if you're going to do much more than just sit around the house, then get a good pair of another type of athletic shoe on or something like that. That was how I would advise for that question.
All right, and that was Ginny, so that you can recognize your question and the answer for
you.
All right. Well, we're going to let Dr. Fawcett go. We really appreciate your time and your patience with all these questions, and hopefully we'll get you back again sometime soon. But I hope you have a good rest of the evening. I look forward to seeing you again next week at the office.
All right, Mr. Bear, thanks for having me. And thanks to everybody that called in, and I'm real glad to chat with you all. Thank you, and have a good night.
All right. Good evening.
Bye-bye.